Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. The Natural Resources Defense Council has been at the forefront of the environmental movement since 1970. It was founded by a group of students and lawyers committed to protecting our air, land, and water from the forces of pollution and from what they saw as corporate greed. More than 45 years later, the organization has 2 million members and operates with a staff of 500 lawyers, scientists, and other professionals. The NRDC has offices in New York, D.C., Chicago, L.A., San Francisco, and Beijing. My guest today is staff scientist Dana Gunders, who works in the NRDC San Francisco office. Her focus is food and agriculture, promoting sustainability throughout food systems and supply chains. Dana's work on reducing food waste has been featured on CNN, NBC, NPR, in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, as well as many other publications. The author of a widely distributed report, Wasted, How America is Losing Up to 40% of Its Food from Farm to Fork to Landfill, Dana also wrote Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, which she describes as, quote, a lighthearted kitchen reference book packed with handy information to help reduce the amount of food wasted in our daily lives. Here's a really stunning statistic. The average household of four spends about $120 a month on food that's never eaten. Dana has a BS and an MS in Earth Systems from Stanford University. So while there will likely be plenty of food for thought in this conversation, let's not waste any more time and meet my guest. Dana, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me begin by saying I have never met anyone who studied Earth Systems. Exactly what does that mean? And quite frankly, I only thought that there was one Earth system.
Good point. You know, the idea behind Earth systems is that there are several different systems that we exist and we rely upon for our existence, and they interplay with how we operate as a society. So we really, as part of my studies, looked at Earth sciences and how they connect to what people are doing and our impact as people and as society on the planet and vice versa. It actually was a strangely natural background for me to now get into the food system and how we as people are sort of operating within what it takes to produce food on the planet.
Well, how, why, and when did you become interested in our Earth and its systems?
Oh, goodness. I think I've always been a little bit of a nature child from the time I was really young, just going out with my grandmother, who was very into birds and feeding the pigeons in the park and this kind of thing, all the way through, you know, till I got older and like to recreate outdoors quite a bit. So it's sort of always been in my DNA.
Did you find yourself an anomaly in that field in college? I bet you were a definite minority.
Absolutely, definite minority. I actually, within that field, focused on energy efficiency when I was in college, and there were only 8 people in the whole class that had focused along with me. So we were just a few of us.
Well, how many of the 8 were female?
Well, in the energy world, very few, actually. It was mostly males in the energy efficiency space. But now in the sustainable food world, it's almost all female.
So how did you move into that area after you got out of school? Where did you go professionally?
I had a meandering path.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I actually spent some time as a mediator for big, hairy natural resource issues. So, for instance, when a dam comes up for relicensing, there's about 30 to 40 different parties who want to say in what the terms of the license of that dam will be, because the license lasts for 50 to 100 years. So we would could get right in the middle of all those different, you know, fishermen and boaters and farmers and anyone who cared about, you know, how much water there was going to be in the river and what temperature it was going to be, things like that, and mediate that.
Who employs a mediator?
There are actually mediation companies that get hired to do this sort of thing.
Oh, and so you're along with the group, but you're not the sole mediator for the Hoover Dam, are you?
I was a young whippersnapper following around much more experienced people at that point. Who you know, I mean, these processes take years, and there are hundreds of people involved, and so it really does take a central party to keep everything moving and keep the various parties speaking to each other and happy.
And from there?
From there, a romantic interest took me to Asia.
Oh.
Where I actually rode my bicycle for about 9 months across 7 different countries and landed. The last country we were in was India. And because we got there during the summertime when it was very hot in kind of mainland India, we went up north. And we wound up doing a program where we lived with a family in the Himalayas in northern India.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it was an incredible experience. And these families were subsistence farmers for the most part. And so we would help with the harvest and, you know, with the various activities around that. And that is really what sparked my interest in food.
You just happened to fall into this? Were you there under a particular auspices or program?
There was a program that kind of, you know, placed us in these homes, and that program really highlighted, as part of the sort of like introduction to the program and orientation, how much the global food system had really impacted these families who had been completely, you know, self-sufficient, but then things like rice crept into their diets, and you can't grow rice in the Himalayas because it requires too much water.
Right.
And so all of a sudden they needed money to buy rice. And so all of a sudden they needed to have a job to, you know, have money to buy rice.
Right,
and things
right.
just kind of went from there. And it really illuminated for me how connected the global food system is and how much of an impact it's having on people in so many different ways beyond just what they're eating.
What year was that and how old were you?
That was 2005, and I was 27, 28.
And how long did you spend living with this family in the Himalayas?
Just about 2 months. It had an incredible impact because, you know, what I saw was that these people, they basically lived in a national park. You know, they lived in this gorgeous place. They had beautiful homes. They had tight-knit communities. They were safe. They had all of these things that we in the Western world would just die for, right? And I would sit there and go, gosh, you know, people would pay millions of dollars to have a home sited right here with this tight community and fresh organic food and all of this. And all they wanted to do was move to the city to make money so they could buy stuff. And it was a really poignant experience for me to just see those pressures on them and the juxtaposition of what they wanted versus, you know, what's desirable here.
So you leave and you come back to the States. And what happens to you then?
I spend about a year trying to work in the food industry with no experience, having ever worked on anything related to food. And finally land in an organization called Fair Trade USA that certifies products to be fair trade. If you've ever seen that little fair
sure.
trade certification
mm-hmm.
mark.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was working with both farmers on the ground to help them get their fair trade certification and also with big companies that wanted to source those products. So, you know, if Starbucks wants to buy 40 million pounds of coffee, they need that to come from somewhere. And so I was really trying to make the connections within their supply chain of, you know, where the coffee would come from. Is there enough? And is it fair trade? And if not, can we enlist more farmers in the fair trade program to sort of find that quality?
So coffee? There you are. You're now getting more immersed in food matters.
Exactly. So then, you know, I mean, working at fair trade, there's so many neat companies that are interested in fair trade. So, you know, Ben and Jerry's and
sure.
You know, smaller little coffee shops around the country and tea companies and chocolate. And I was also sort of traveling around the world working with farmers, you know, in the hills of Guatemala where they don't even speak Spanish. It was really neat. But ultimately, I wound up wanting to work, just travel a little bit less and work little closer in my community. And that's when I joined NRDC to work on a project with the fruit and vegetable industry, primarily in California, though it was a national project. And that project was looking at sustainable farming and how can we have the whole fruit and vegetable industry start to measure things that are important to sustainability, like air quality and energy use and water use and fertilizer use and things like that, and have them measure it in the same way so that, you know, we can all compare what we're doing.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dana Gunders, who is a staff scientist with the National Resources Defense Council, and her focus is food and agriculture. So you join the NRDC, and basically you have your work cut out for you, don't you?
I did, yeah. I mean, working with the fruit and vegetable industry was fascinating. I learned a ton, very different from small farmers in the hills of Guatemala.
Yeah,
for sure.
I bet. Uh-huh.
And, you know, we had all these different issues we were looking at, and I was put in charge of the group that looked at waste on farms.
There's waste on farms?
Waste on farms, yeah. I mean, just looking at both how much food got wasted, but also, you know, irrigation piping that winds up getting ripped up and thrown out and things like that. Because it was one measure of how sustainable their operation was. And as I am researching to create the initial draft for this group, I start reading, stumbling upon these numbers, like 40% of food is going to waste. And, you know, 25% of all the water in this country is going to grow food that ultimately never gets eaten. And just these staggering, enormous numbers that I really sat there and I thought, these can't be true, because if they were, everybody would be talking about them. You know, we'd all know about it.
So it's almost as if it's a really well-kept secret.
Yeah, I mean, just like, no way, you know, just like, no way, this is crazy. And that really that totally sparked my interest. I mean, I was intrigued by it. I started researching it heavily. I went on a little bit of a rampage within NRDC. Like, we have got to be working on this. This is, you know, essentially, it's just like energy efficiency, but for the food industry. It's the same concept of, you know, being more efficient with what we're producing. And NRDC has a long, long history in working in energy efficiency. And so I thought, gosh, this is perfect, you know, exactly what we should be working on. And so I wrote a whole report. I did all this research and wrote a whole report that was meant to be an internal report to just convince the organization that we should be working on this.
Were you the sole spokesperson in that department in food and agriculture?
No, not at all. We had a few other people, but, you know, working on other things. And this just, it kind of, you know, everyone went, oh yeah, that does seem important. You know, but no one said, oh yeah, totally, go work on that. And that's where I really went on this crusade to try to convince the organization, wow, we should really put some focus into this. And nothing really happened of that, except that I had all this information that I had already collected. And so finally I said, well, let's just put this on the web, you know?
And what year was that?
August 23rd, 2012.
Oh, that recently?
That recently, yeah.
Wow.
And it turns out there was nothing else going on in the news that day. Because CNN put it on their breaking news kind of headline, 40% of food gets wasted. And I think everyone must follow CNN's breaking news or something, because it you know, flew from
there.
Took
on a life of its own, huh?
Absolutely. And next thing you know, young Dana, who has no idea what she's doing, is on NBC Nightly News talking about how much food is going to waste. And, you know, it's ever since then, it's just been this incredible ride of interest in this topic and trying to figure out what we can do about it.
What can we do about it?
Well, still ever trying to figure that out. But certainly as individuals, there's a lot we can do about it. First, just becoming aware, you know, I think as soon as nobody wants to waste food. Nobody wakes up in the morning going, I'm going to waste some food today, or I don't
Right.
really care. But it's happening in our own lives. And once you start thinking about it, you just see it everywhere. And I think just opening your eyes eliminates 5 to 10% of what is going to waste in your own life, because it becomes very obvious and you make different choices around that.
Open my eyes. Tell me what I do that maybe I'm not aware of.
You order something at the restaurant and then you go, oh, I'm not going to eat that. You know, this portion, you know, you get your big plate of something and you sort of push the potatoes aside or the pasta salad aside and you just don't eat it. Right. You just leave it there.
Or I take it home in a doggy bag.
And that's fantastic if you do. And then you have to remember to eat it. if you
yeah.
do that,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Certainly the better option, but just serving people, certainly parties. When you host parties and there's so much extra food around, a lot of, you know, that the plates get scraped and sometimes people take too much and, you'll see it's everywhere. I bet you'll see.
Even if I'm not throwing a party and I'm not going out for dinner, just in my boring daily life, I gather I'm doing that as well. I mean, I mean that I gather. Sometimes I see myself do that, but other times, you know, I make for me what I know I can consume.
Yeah. And the more you can do that, the better. And, you know, I mean, it's the lettuce that goes bad in your fridge. It's those leftovers that you put in and they were in like an opaque container and you kind of forgot about them. And then
right.
a week later, you're like, oh, man.
Or all of a sudden I notice the expiration date on something and it's been in my refrigerator for 3 months and it gets tossed.
Right. And that's a great point. Expiration dates are a big source of confusion out there because many people believe that they indicate, you know, that basically they're telling you to throw the food out when in fact, they're really just telling you that's when the food is at its freshest until. And they're not regulated. They're not actually meant to indicate anything about the safety of food or food getting you sick. They really are just a quality indicator. And food can often be eaten days, weeks, or months after.
Oh, man, I am playing this piece over and over again for my sons who come to my house and open the refrigerator and I can't believe this is still here, whether it's cheese, whatever, and toss it. And this is... I feel so empowered by just having heard you say that about expiration dates. They almost seem, you know, frivolous or fanciful. You know what I mean? That there's no kind of basis in fact to them, right?
No. And, you know, I mean, certainly I think manufacturers use some kind of method, but there's no standard method. So some of them, you know, how do you come up with those dates? It's not that, you know, the government says it has to be this number of days or anything like that. It's really, you know, the manufacturer sitting there going, well, let's have a focus group and they'll take 10 people and they'll have them taste the product at different time frames. And when a majority of them rate it less than a 7 out of 10, that's the date they use or something like that.
Well, that's really interesting. Now, combine what we're talking about in terms of your report with the book that you wrote, The Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. What sparked that book?
So I came out with this report.
Right.
And
it takes everybody by storm.
It takes everyone by storm. It just really resonated with everyone, right? I mean, it is surprising that we waste so much food. And nobody feels good about that. And so what I noticed is that people hear this, they want to do something about it, they're ready to, and yet somehow they go back into their own lives and it just keeps happening. And so I wanted to provide kind of both information and inspiration for people who were aware of the issue to actually, you know what to do in order to act in their own lives and in their own kitchens and have the right information at their fingertips in order to do that. So the book has kind of three different sections. One, the first is just strategies. You know, how do you shop a little bit smarter? What do you need to know about storing food? How can you tell if you can still eat something? What can you do with your food scraps? So there are different chapters on those things. And then there's a recipe section that has ideas both on how to use up kind of everything in your fridge that you need to use up, different recipes that can do that. And then others that are really targeted at one product. So, you know, avocados, there's a recipe in there for buried chocolate avocado mousse that when your avocados get really overripe and kind of brown or mushy, you can actually make a chocolate mousse out of them.
And are you kidding?
It's delicious. It replaces the cream and the butter. It's healthier. You can't taste anything weird. And it's so good that I've been making it at all, you know, any book events that I've had, I make it and hand it out and everyone's loved it.
Oh my God. Well, because I have a rotten avocado on my windowsill. That's just basically taking up space. That's amazing. What else? What other recipes are in there?
Well, there's one for sautéed lettuce. You know, a lot of
sautéed
people buy
lettuce?
Those. Yeah, so you buy those like bags of mixed greens or lettuce, regular lettuce, and it starts to go bad. You know, maybe it gets one or two leaves get a little slimy in the bag or something. A lot of people just throw it out. But actually, you can cook lettuce. I mean, you cook all your other greens, right? So why not? And any of the weird like slightly yellow or slightly brown tip or things like that, just kind of, you know, go away.
I mean, but Dana, are you a chef?
No, I'm not. But I do cook and I do eat. And, you know,
so you fulfill two of that criteria.
Right, exactly. The book is really not aimed at people who are, you know, very fancy cooks. This is about your everyday life and your everyday food management and just ideas on how you can use things that maybe you thought you had to throw away.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dana Gunders, who is a staff scientist with the National Resources Defense Council, and her focus is food and agriculture. Tell us how we can better manage our food. I don't mean in 10 easy steps or whatever, but throw out some ideas that on some level may seem so obvious, but despite that, we even missed them.
A lot of it are sort of old world classic habits, like people who use shopping lists tend to have lower grocery bills. They buy, you know, less unplanned purchases. The average person who goes into a store without a shopping list, about 55% of their purchases are unplanned.
Hmm.
You know, they get home and they don't necessarily know what they're going to do with those things.
So it's impulse buying.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, really kind of having a plan when you go shopping is a good thing. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to sit down on Sunday night with a cookbook for 2 hours and, you know, write out the 8 recipes you're going to do that week. I think there are ways to just, you know, think about your week ahead. Think about how many nights you're actually going to be able to cook, because a lot of times people are busy. And the reality is you may only wind up cooking a couple nights a week. And the other nights you're either putting a frozen pizza in the oven, getting takeout, going out with friends, whatever it may be. So I think acknowledging that there are those lazy nights is important, and planning only for, you know, a couple meals that you actually are going to have the time and energy to cook. And those meals can be the meals that you like, you know, your old standbys, as opposed to having to go to a cookbook and come up with new recipes.
But what about the concept of buying in bulk, because that's cheaper and that makes more sense?
Well, I would argue that it's only cheaper if you actually eat the food.
Right, of course.
So it's not cheaper if you wind up throwing a bunch of it out. Now, certain things lend themselves to that better than others. So, you know, if you go buy a big bag of chicken breasts, as long as you freeze most of them, that may work out fine. But if you put them in the fridge, it may not. So my recommendation is that when you do buy in bulk, make sure you set aside a little bit of time for when you get home to really kind of process your purchases correctly and use your freezer, you know, portion things right, freeze each chicken breast separately if you can, so that you only have to defrost one at a time or whatever portions you usually cook with, and do things like that so that you don't get stuck with product that goes bad.
So what do we do with our excess food or the stuff we haven't finished eating, aside from the obvious of composting it?
First, of course, you want to try to cook in the right portions, right? And so you don't wind up with a lot of extra food that you don't want. A lot of people like to take leftovers for lunch and, you know, eat them the next night, and that's great. You certainly can freeze a lot of things. I think people kind of vastly underutilize their freezers. But certainly, if you have extra food, you know, you made dinner, it was really good, you're probably not going to want to eat it tomorrow and there's extra, then pop it in your freezer. And things can go in the freezer for just a few days. I think most people think that there's like this connection that when you put something in the freezer, it's going to be there for months.
Mm.
But actually, there's no reason that you can't just, you know, take whatever soup you made, put it in the freezer for 5 days, and then have it, you know, a few days later when you're in the mood for it again.
Right.
So the book, you know, the book actually has a whole directory, which is like the third part of the book, that has 85 common food products. And it has advice on how to store those products. So, you know, how long they're good for, do they go in the refrigerator? Does the tomato go in the refrigerator? Does it not? And does it go in a plastic bag? Does it not? What are those crisper drawers for? You know, should it go in there? And it also has a section on freezing for each of those products. And it describes what the best way to freeze each of those products is in order to have the highest quality of those products.
Does your book, Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, the Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, does it debunk food myths?
It does. Absolutely. I mean, I think the expiration date topic that we already
touched
on. Right.
That's a big one as far as I'm concerned.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And along with that, just this idea that old food can make you sick. So I think there is a kind of fundamental confusion out there that people get sick from food when it's old. And actually, people get sick from food when it's contaminated, but not because it's old. So when you hear about, you know, E. coli and salmonella and all these food, you know, poisoning outbreaks, well, that's, you know, those things like E. coli, they get on the food either at the farm or the processing plant, they contaminate it, and then they will get you sick whether that food is old or not. And, you know, thankfully, a lot of our food does not have that on it. But things like making sure you cook your chicken well, that's going to help you not get sick from food. And not eating raw eggs and keeping your kitchen clean and things like that. When food gets old and just ages, like that's a natural process of decay. And there are different bacteria and enzymes involved in that. And those are not actually going to get you sick. And our body is very well equipped to know when not to eat food because it's old. So that's when, you know, something tastes bad, something smells bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of past the point where you'd want to eat it. But if it tastes okay and smells okay, you know, as long as it hasn't mistakenly been contaminated earlier on in its production, it'll be fine and it won't make you sick.
What's your take on organic food versus non-organic? Should I be eating organically grown eggs?
From a waste standpoint and from a safety standpoint, I don't think there's any difference. But from kind of a greater planetary standpoint, there certainly is. You know, organic products use a lot less pesticides.
Mm.
And they're kind of, you know, they make for a better planet.
Dana, we've basically run out of time. I think we could just talk on and on and on about this. It's really been a fascinating conversation. But I can't end this interview without making a reference to your trip to Asia for a romantic interest. Did that continue when you came back to the States?
Well, it did, but not for all that long.
Oh, okay. I didn't want it to embarrass you or just let it hang there. I just, because that, boy, that is really a kind of a, you really get to know somebody as you're biking across Asia and living in the Himalayas with somebody.
It's true. And we're still good friends because, you know, you can't really ever replace that experience with anyone else.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for joining me today. Again, forgive the, you know, the bad pun, but there really is a lot of food for thought in terms of what you shared with us today. And we need people like you to get us back on the straight and narrow.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for having me, Sandy. It was a great discussion.
Well, thank you, too. If you have an idea for a guest or any interview suggestions, please contact us at sandyklineshow.com. Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.